by for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, Drew Kirby.
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors, and as always, we reach out to Wyoming Game and Fish Department's Janet Millick to get us information that we feel is very important and integral to what anglers and hunters and outdoor folks need to know about Wyoming. And Janet, one that I think a lot of people are itching to do is get out fishing. We've had an odd year. The ice isn't as good as it should be this time of year. There's open water in some places, so anglers that aren't getting that opportunity are chomping at the bit.
That's right. And you know, it's been such a crazy year, just like you were talking about. We're sitting here watching it snow now. But last week we were, you know, loving 60 degree temperatures and really saw a few drift boats going by the office. So we do know that there are quite a few people that are out and enjoying it. But one of the things that I think is super interesting, Drew, is, you know, when I first started with Game and Fish years and years and years ago, I always kind of had this perception that there would be busy times and there would be not busy times, right? That wildlife guys would be busy during the hunting season and fisheries folks would be busy during the fishing season, and that maybe there would be a little bit of downtime in between. And it has become clear, and more as we continue to take on more and more work, that there is no downtime for anyone anymore. So even as we're watching the snow fly, our fish guys are super busy, whether they're out doing research, doing some scientific surveys, or whether they're in the office crunching numbers, whether they're making a plan for what's to come. Like year round now, we are thinking about what people are going to want to be doing for fishing, when and where.
So one of the things that I mentioned with ice fishing being so different, we've got a lot of opportunity for fishing in this area, whether it be the river, which you could fish that all through the winter or summer or, you know, the fall. But then a lot of these, the reservoirs that we have around this general area of Casper, I mean, there are some big fisheries, and there's a lot of these reservoirs that takes a lot of work to maintain them and to get, you know, things going for the next season. And when I say season, I mean weather season, because, you know, who knows what it's going to be and when it's going to be. But these guys really are working on the next season before it even gets here.
Oh, and in fact, it's years and years out. It's kind of interesting to think. And we have Jeff and Matt here today to talk to us a little bit about some of the planning that goes into these fisheries. And I don't think that people necessarily recognize how complex it is. We often get these folks that think, you know, that, oh, gosh, if I just put this particular species or kind of fish into this water, it's going to grow. It's going to be great. And in a year, I'm going to have the best cutthroat trout fishery in the world. But in fact, that is not what happens. And there is a lot of science that goes into it. And so wild diversity is absolutely a goal that Game and Fish does strive for anglers, in the sense of we do want to provide cool water fisheries, cold water fisheries, and warm water fisheries, all very accessible to anglers across the state. You know, the conditions, the habitat, all have to be right for those biologists to be able to manage the waters in those ways. And so whether you are ice fishing or whether you're heading out on your drift boat, these guys are here to talk to you about what goes into it and why.
So let's just start, Jeff. What does go into maintaining these fisheries? I mean, we start early in the year, but how do you really think about what you're going to do on some of these opportunities?
Yeah, so it would all depend on the type of water that you're considering. Some of the smaller ponds, they're fairly easy. It's kind of a, if there's water, you can try mostly around here, it'll be trout. But what gets complex is whenever you have larger bodies of water and you're trying to balance multiple species and also different kind of hydrological or water quality issues as well. So a good example of a more complex one around here that has been very good was Goldeneye Reservoir. In a place like that, for years, the water was nice and clean and somewhat salty, and it actually grew really nice trout. And it became kind of regionally known for that. And over the many past decades, they've tried a number of different species in those, in Goldeneye namely. And you kind of have a record of the past of what did and didn't work. So you can go back to those when you're considering what to plan for in the future. What worked 20, 30 years ago? What maybe has come with new species and hatchery availability that you can try in the future? And then you have to come up with a programmatic sampling that you can actually keep tabs on those type of species, and the types of sampling that you use changes by species. You know, a bass or a crappie does not get caught just as well in the same gill nets that the trout get and walleye get caught in. So it kind of comes down to balancing how you sample. Each place is different, what you sample, and then what you prescribe for species changes. And it's all a function of water quality, salinity, turbidity, depth through the winter, duration of ice cover, a number of different things that goes into that.
So all year, the obvious seasons are different. Are you collecting a different type of data in the different seasons that we have?
Yeah, so in the spring at most of our lakes, we'll go out and we'll sample for trout. We use floating gill nets because come ice off, most of the trout focus on feeding and regaining any lost weight from like kind of like the doldrums of winter where there's not a lot of bait and zooplankton swimming around. So they'll swim around the shorelines, and so we can target those by setting strategically floating gill nets that angle off of shore. But in the fall, when we want to sample for, say, walleye, we have to set sinking gill nets in about 20 to 40 feet of water. And we also do those kind of near shore because we know from using tracking studies from other places and past experience that walleye do something called a diurnal movement where they go deeper during the day and at night they come into the shallows to feed. So if you can set nets kind of in the transition zone between the two, you have a good chance of catching moving fish.
So, Jeff, the data that you're collecting, does that just help maintain weight you have a Goldeneye, or is that going to better it in the future?
So the information that we gain on any kind of year-to-year basis is actually kind of just one piece of a larger set of information that we have been collecting for years and years in some of these locations. So, yes, we use it to kind of guide what's going on in the future. If we notice, say, some kind of really sudden downturn, we know that maybe something has pretty quickly or abruptly changed about the habitat. But ultimately, you're just contributing at this point to long-term management of these locations and seeing whether or not maybe other species could go in, or instead of just maintaining it as it is, you can actually say, if the body condition of fish, which is a measure of how healthy or plump they are, if that goes up or if it stays really high, maybe we could raise the number of fish that go in because clearly they're not having trouble eating. And if we do that, maybe we can look at stocking different species of, you know, for example, in Goldeneye, trout. We've gone from historically only stocking rainbow trout. Then sometime about 5 or 6 years ago, we really started to pack in a wide variety of cutthroat species, Bear River cutthroat and Snake River cutthroat. And in the past, many years ago, they had a whole nother array of species that they found just didn't work in that location. So we kind of know which ones from the past sampling, it informs the future.
What are the advantages if you have more than you know, just a couple of species in a body of water like that?
One of the biggest ones is just that it makes more fish available to people at a broader time of year. So rather than having just trout moving around the shoreline, even different species of trout we have found, for example, at Alcova, the rainbow trout tend to come into shore pretty early in the season, but Bear River cutthroat become more available in the summer months to people. And then you have in Alcova, you have walleye, and they become more available to people early in the spring and later in the fall. So by having a diversity of species, you can cover the gamut of angling interest and angler availability from the earliest part of the year all the way until basically the end.
Wow, it's so wild how much actually goes into maintaining all the fisheries around Wyoming. So hang on just a minute. We're back with Wyoming Game and Fish to talk more about the history and maintenance of keeping all these fisheries tip-top on Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Our conversation today with Game and Fish is all about how to maintain the fisheries that we have and keep them being some of the best in the country. We have Matt, Janet, and Jeff with us today. And Jeff, how far back is there actual data that can be used to make plans for the future of the fisheries?
Yeah, so you know, some of the ponds around here, for out in the 33-mile country, we've got a lot of ponds. Those were built in like the 80s and 90s. So some of those don't have records that go back terribly far, but about 20, 30 years. And then other places we have that go back 60 or 70 years. In terms of routine monitoring, we have an older system called a card file, which is kind of like the old library card system, where they would go in and on individual note cards, they would write down when they had gone there. And some of those records go back to the 20s. So we'll use that for maybe what species had been stocked and tried. If we're, you know, instead of reinventing the wheel, if we're thinking about putting a new species somewhere, we'll go back and see, like, has it ever been tried before?
So, and that's in the case of the sauger, where it was prominent here for such a long time and then went away. So research shows that sauger should do well and is probably the reason that it was brought back?
Yes, yeah, so sauger, not only were they found in the river by people who worked here, but that's actually from kind of historical anecdote in journal articles from soldiers that were at the Fort Laramie back in the late 1800s. Now, they didn't call them.
Yeah, there was even an archaeological dig at Fort Laramie at the old historic site there, where they excavated the old, basically the dump that was the fort's dump. And they found a lot of fish bones that had been discarded in their trash there. And just by looking at the shape and things of the bones, you can often tell the species of the fish. And they, you know, documented that, yeah, it was kind of funny. The officers had a different dump than the enlisted men, and the officers were eating a lot of sauger, and the enlisted men were eating a lot of suckers. So, you know, it's kind of funny, but
not much else has changed, has it?
Yeah, but no, through old scientific expeditions like the Hayden expedition that was in the 1870s, I believe, a few other, at the time it was the U.S. Biological Survey. I mean, we're going back into the 1800s, and they all found, you know, sauger were quite widespread in the river, sturgeon, shovel-nose sturgeon, gold eye, some other species that had been extirpated from the river. And there's good historical evidence that, you know, we know, yeah, 100% those fish were here and were native and were doing really well. It's good information to go back and find.
So in the case of, say, sauger, are they stocked anywhere else other than just the North Platte River, and then they trickle into Glendale? Are there other reservoirs that they are stocked in?
No, they're a river species. And back when sauger were here on a kind of natural term, there wouldn't have been any of these dams or reservoirs for them to have inhabited. Now, they can do well somewhat, like over in the Lander region, for example. They're native to the Wind River, and they'll make their way into Boisen, and they'll use like the headwater upper ends of that. But I think, you know, one thing that kind of gets lost in people's minds in modern times is that the river that we see now that runs from, say, Gray Reef down looks vastly different than it would have back in the 1800s and early 1900s, whenever those fish were here en masse and doing well. There's old descriptions of the Platte that was an inch deep and a mile wide. It was times a year when it would kind of dry up to almost nothing and just have pockets of water left that were kind of deep pools. But for the most part, it was a natural hydrograph, which means that it was subject to the flows that were given to it by rain or snow melt. And come summer, it would warm up and get really shallow. And it was extremely braided, very wide, and had a multi-thread channel, which just means that it has no one course or set hardened path. But since the development of reservoirs and a regulated hydrograph or flow structure, and also setting the river channel in kind of like what is a riprap or a hardened base, it keeps it from wandering or meandering too much. Your listeners could even go on Google Earth, and one of the neat things that we've done is you can go on these satellite imagery maps and you can see old oxbows kind of out in like the Bessemer Bend Government Bridge country. You can see that the river used to swing over a mile or two wide on that whole valley, and it has left little oxbow lakes and little water depressions in what are very evident as old river channel.
You know, we talk about history repeating itself sometimes. Do you think that in the future we could be having this conversation of, oh, look, the river has moved again, or it's flowing in a different path? Or with management and everything, is it basically probably going to stay where it is?
In all likelihood, the river is kind of set where it's going to be. We've now, we don't really foresee that being a thing. And if anything, there's actually kind of a nationwide trend of removing certain hydroelectric dams as they become either outdated, backfilled with sediment, or just kind of unnecessary or unusable. Really, the stability of the system actually makes it somewhat easier to manage because it becomes a little bit more predictable. When you have a natural hydrograph, every year is kind of like playing roulette. It's just a shot in the dark as to what you're going to get. You could get even one rain on top of snow or ice event that just causes massive flooding. We don't really see that anymore. And because we know year after year how the river is most likely going to be run, or how certain reservoirs are going to be run or orchestrated, we can prescribe, we work our stocking scheduling out 3 years in advance already. It becomes a little bit just more stability, actually brings a little bit of ease to the idea.
How far in advance? You said 3 years out you have what you're going to stock, but how far prior to that are you looking in places like Goldeneye saying, okay, we want to put this type of fish here this year or this type of fish here?
Yeah, so one of the things that really happened at Goldeneye that was complicated is that it kind of got to become really turbid in the summer of 2019, which just means it became really muddy. And when it was really gin clear water, the trout did exceedingly well. They grew very quickly. They got to pretty large ultimate sizes, and we didn't really have too many problems with it. Once it got a little bit turbid, those larger fish, they take a huge energetic demand to upkeep. It's kind of, they don't just persist on little bugs. They need larger prey, sucker minnows, fathead minnows, whatnot. So when that water becomes turbid and they're visual predators, they can't see those bigger sources. A lot of those really large fish died off. After a couple of years of looking, we noticed that the trout stocks have gone down. The stocking success had gone down. So we looked at the old card file system, and we found in the 1930s that there was an angling group out there when that land was all private that had leased that water right and stocked crappie into the system. And they found them that they, you know, black crappie grew up to 15 inches by the late 1930s into the 1950s. And at the time, it was going through a similar, it was noted that the water was similarly turbid or muddy. So we put together a plan to just, if we can't create biomass of trout in that system, we still want anglers to have a good opportunity to go out there and fish. So using that old information, we started stocking black crappie. And I've gotten a couple of reports even through this winter that fish that we stocked at about the size of a quarter are now about 8 inches long. Now, there's not very many of them in there yet. It was kind of an opportunistic stocking of extras, but it is now on the regular schedule in the near future to start receiving that on a routine basis.
So what you're saying is Goldeneye might be coming back?
Goldeneye is at least coming back in terms of a cool water fishery in, if it's not going to be the trout fishery it once was at this time. But the thing about Goldeneye as well is that it's very shallow. So this winter is obviously not going to do anything to it. But on a hard winter where we get deep ice, a lot of snow on top of the ice, and it persists for long enough to create what we call a winter kill situation, it's where a lack of daylight getting through the ice allows the decomposition of plants to consume all of the oxygen underneath the ice in the water, and it kills the fish. If that resets Goldeneye through a die-off event, we could put trout in there the very next month as soon as it opens up, and they probably do as well as they had done back in the mid-2000s.
So the research that you guys do all year long actually pays off, because things like being not as thick of an ice year could really be something to help in the future of fish.
Yeah, you know, this is the kind of year that allows fish to persist in some of our smaller, shallower ponds that sometimes flirt with a risk of dying off. So the fish that we put into the 33-mile ponds north of the airport will most likely have at least a whole second season of growth under their belt as anglers go into the summer months and want to go out there and try to fish for them. So rather than being 6 or 7 inches, they could be 14 to 16 inches.
So as you see, Drew, like, things can be really complicated. There is a lot that goes into it, not only just management planning, but all the natural things that are around us when we're trying to do the science and when we're trying to think about fisheries in Wyoming. So I think it's always, you know, something to remind listeners that we're always more than welcome to talk to them about the conditions of the fisheries around the state. And if they have any questions, don't hesitate to reach out, because we would love to talk to anyone at any time about what's going on.
As always, it's so informative, and I love that we have this connection and this ability to talk about things like this. And Janet, Matt, and Jeff, thank you guys so much. Back in just minutes with Brian from Rocky Mountain Discount Sports.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Drunk Brian and Rocky Mountain Discount Sports, where, well, it came and went. Goose season is gone, Brian.
Waterfowl season in this area is pretty much done, with the exception of some late season snow goose hunting.
So what that may mean is there are guys that were blaming the missing on their gun, and then maybe they could have, because they hadn't cleaned it for a while. So now would be a good time for that.
Yeah, you know, this is a good time, especially after this last weekend. Wind was blowing. We had snow drifting in the blinds, and everything got wet. And, you know, now's a good time to get those guns taken apart, get them cleaned out, get them re-lubricated, and make sure that they're dried up so that you don't have rust and end up with a problem next season.
So one of the things my grandpa always preached was, anytime you shoot your gun, you should clean your gun. But I would say, with the way that, you know, the materials are made these days and the cleaning solutions, that may be a stretch now.
Yeah, I mean, I clean my gun once and if I start having problems with it. You know, I mean, there's no sense to fix something that's not broken. But, yeah, a lot of times, you know, depending on how you're using it, you know, and what kind of shotgun shells you're using. And some shotgun shells are dirtier than others, and you get a little bit of blowback from some of that powder discharge. But, you know, if you're a guy like myself and you're laying in fields and you got blowing dirt and blowing corn stalks, right, and that kind of stuff that are jamming up your actions, I mean, you might have to clean them a little more frequently.
So, and we had talked a little bit, and I know Jesse and I had a conversation. I have a gun that, you know, it wasn't ejecting the shells and it wasn't, you know, pulling back. And you had mentioned that part of that issue could have been maybe the weight of the bullet or the grain in that bullet. And there are many different things that can contribute to an issue.
Yeah, especially on semi-automatic rifles and shotguns. You know, a lot of times, especially on the shotguns, most of the shotguns that we're seeing anymore are being made over in Turkey. They're being shipped with a heavy, like, cosmoline. And, you know, a lot of guys just, you know, want to grab their shotgun, go out to the trap range and start, you know, blasting away. And then they experience some problems with cycling issues. But if a guy actually takes their gun home, cleans out that cosmoline, that heavy shipping grease that's in there, and then just goes back and puts a light coating of oil on it, a lot of times, you know, those guns never see a problem with cycling. But generally, you know, only an issue on the semi-automatics. You know, pump shotguns and break action shotguns, generally you don't see those issues. But yeah, I mean, it's good to, you know, learn how to, you know, tear apart your guns and how to clean them properly. And I always feel that the lighter the lubricant, the better, you know, for those guns, because they don't have to worry about, like, especially cold conditions. Some of that oil that you use will actually harden up kind of, or just kind of slow things down. And if you think of like a grease, you know, as a bacon grease, you know, as it cools down, it hardens up. And sometimes there's certain lubricants out there that do the same thing in shotguns and rifles.
And of course, in you guys have a whole section of nothing but cleaning supplies and utensils. So coming in and making sure you have the right items for the guns that you're shooting, and maybe you're looking for a new gun altogether.
Yeah, I mean, we're just getting out of these shows that we had here in the springtime, and boy, things are shipping really well this year, different than the last 3 years for sure. Items like those Smith & Wesson revolvers that have been hard to get, we've got a huge selection of those right now. And then just some of the 75th anniversary Rugers that have been out that were announced. We're seeing some of the SHOT Show guns coming through already. A lot of the new Ruger Gen 2s, we're starting to see some of those calibers come through. So, yeah, if you've, if you're one of those guys that's been kind of watching the SHOT Show and some of those newer guns, come on in and talk to us. If we don't have them in yet, I'm sure they're on order, and we'll certainly put your name. And we kind of keep a list of those hard-to-find guns. The Marlins that have been really difficult to get, we got a good shipment of those in this last week, those 1895s and that kind of stuff. So, come on in, talk to the guys at the gun counter, give us your name. If we don't have it in, we'll hunt it down. We've got a lot of different resources that we use to get those guns, a lot of different distributors, and we're direct with almost every manufacturer out there. So
really, if someone goes online and they find this gun somewhere online and they're like, oh, I'm going to get it, well, they're going to have it shipped to the store anyway and have it all transferred over.
Right.
And so they might as well come in and just work directly with you guys, and you can help them right along.
Yeah, I mean, it's sure nice to be able to support your local businesses first. I mean, yeah. I know sometimes it's, really convenient just because you see a gun online and you're like, yep, that's the one I want, and I just order it. But, don't be afraid to give us a call and have us, do a little digging around and research. Hopefully we can meet or beat the price you're going to find online. And for sure, if we order the gun for you, we're going to save you that $35 transfer fee.
Yeah, so it really does pay to come in and check them out here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. And, maybe you had a slow waterfowl season like a lot of people did, and some guys went out and didn't see anything for a whole hunting trip, but you still want to shoot. Shooting clays is a great way to keep you in the muscle memory and keep you into the trend.
Yeah, and we do sell the memberships up to Stuckanoff. So, guys that want to go up there and sight in their rifles or plink around, they also have an area up there that you can take a box of clay targets up there, and they've got throwers, so you can go up there and spend an afternoon. Really, it's a great way to support another local organization, and the money that they bring in, really just pays for upgrades into the functions up there. And then there's also the Casper Skeet and Trap Club, also Rocky Mountain Range gun range out there off of Coal Creek. There's lots of places to go shoot a shotgun and go on a one of their Friday night meet shoots. All that kind of stuff is fun, and it's pretty inexpensive to do, and gets you outside and covers the time before fishing season really kicks in.
Yeah, right. And, I was just talking to Lindsay with HD Outdoor, and they'll, Clays for the Brave is coming up this summer. And so you might as well go out and get yourself into the rhythm and get yourself feeling good on the course.
Well, yeah. A lot of times we don't get a whole lot of shots when we're big game hunting, right? If you had any problems doing that, now's a good time to get into the indoor range or get up to Stuckanoff's on one of these nice days that we're having. I mean, 50 degree weather and a day off, it's a great way to spend an afternoon sighting in a gun or just, increasing your proficiency and your accuracy. So,
and on a side note, if you're going to get out and maybe take the side by side or the quad out, you got to make sure you have that ORV because it's been stuck away all winter long. And if you're going to get out in this night weather, you got to get that.
Yeah, and the state parks changed their system again this year. So, if you thought you were really versatile on their old site, it's changed again. Ugh. So you're going to have to create a new user profile, and that's going to be important for reservations when you start going to any of these state parks, Glendale, Boisen, Keyhole, Seminole Reservoir. You got to make sure that you've got you can be that you're activated so you can put in your reservations. And I think 120 days out. So we're getting real close to those summertime reservations.
So obviously it seems a little confusing, but if you come in, they can walk you right through it and get you all taken care of right here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Thanks for sticking around here on Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. If you have missed any of our shows, you can go check them out on demand right inside our radio station's app. Anything for the last, wow, it's almost, are we going on 3 years already?
Close to three already. Yeah.
That's absolutely insane that it's been that long. And, you know, you and I have done some fishing over the last 3 years. To this summer, I think that it's going to be a great year for fishing, whether or not it's, you know, on Glendale or where it's going
to
be.
Yeah, I think me and you need to get in a drift boat and probably take advantage of some of this good early spring fishing as well.
And, you know, we were just looking at some of the ice on the lakes and the reservoirs, and it's starting to look a little choppy on some of these places. So those drift boats could be looking really good to people.
Yeah, you know, I'm talking to a couple of the guys at Blake down at the Ugly Bug Fly Shop. You know, there's certain parts of Wyoming, especially like over in Thermopolis, where the spawn is already in full swing. You know, they're 20-30% through the spawning.
Wow.
And through the plat system up here, you know, the guys are already seeing fish on the reds, and they tend to kind of drag out the spawn a little bit longer probably through these areas. But, yeah, the fishing right now, I mean, if you can pick the right day, right conditions, now's a good time to book a trip with one of the local fly shops and get on the river and experience it, because the fishing is fantastic right now.
What are some of the thought processes when you're trying to look for a good day? What's the best thing to look for?
Well, I mean, obviously, when you're in a drift boat and you're running a fly rod, I mean, the less wind as possible is the best, you know. And obviously, you know, this last week with 50 degree weather, you know, there was a handful of days in there that would have been great, you know. There's going to be some days that you don't want to be out there. I mean, you know, guys are still rowing drift boats, and they're rowing up and through a lot of the same holes multiple times in certain runs. So, it's kind of hard to predict. But, you know, if you've got, you know, beginning of the week and you got a day off Wednesday or Thursday, and you're looking at it going, man, Thursday is supposed to be 50 degrees and low wind, I mean, I would definitely get on the phone and see if I can find a trip to book.
Yeah, definitely nice weather makes it, gives you that itch that you've been waiting for all winter. And it's been kind of a weird, odd winter, but guys that maybe start fishing on the ice in December and stay on the ice until March, I mean, they're probably really jonesing for a good outing.
Yeah, you know, the ice conditions are still pretty sketchy in certain areas. I mean, there's still plenty of decent ice in certain areas. But, there's Alcove Reservoir was pretty wide open this last week. I think Grey Rocks is getting really close if it's not open now. And Glenda will be behind it probably here in a couple, 3 weeks. So,
yeah, we were down in Saratoga last weekend. And, you know, there was lots of good ice there in Saratoga, but places like Boysen, where there's okay ice, but then there's some sections that are a little rough. So it does get a little spooky to get out and, you know, mess around on the ice a little bit.
Yeah, I'm trying to be as patient as I can before I drag that boat out. You know, I mean, especially condition-wise, and you want to have a nice day where you can get that boat out and really make sure everything is operating properly. You know, you don't want to be stuck out there in bad conditions and have the wind push you up against a bunch of rocks and ruin a day, or get trapped with a big block of ice that might, you know, prevent you from getting back to the boat ramp. So
we talked a little bit last week, if you're really, really, really jonesing but you don't want to risk it, now would be a good time to maybe go through your boat, you know, and maybe upgrade and, you know, look for some new electronics and all your equipment.
Yeah, you know, pretty much every season it seems like I have one battery go bad in my boat, you know, and, you know, they last 3 or 4 years anymore. And making sure that you can get a good charge on them and that they're going to hold. If you haven't had your boat plugged in over the winter, it's going to be a good opportunity to get your batteries, you know, take them in, get them checked for a load test on them. I've been using batteries plus bulbs here in Casper up there in the Triangle Plaza across from Home Depot. They've been super knowledgeable. The batteries that I've been getting from them have been really good. They've been lasting a long time. So another local business that, you know, good to support and make sure that you're prepped for the season.
And I know we talked a little bit about the Wyoming Walleye Stampede, where you guys are really looking good, and where you have four different rounds, and where are you going to be at this year?
Yes, we have three regular season events. Two of them are going to be at Glendo. The third one will be at Boysen. And then our championship for our top 60 teams will be held at Pathfinder Reservoir.
So last year it was Seminole and then Boysen for the championship. Correct. So this year, Boysen and Pathfinder.
Actually, I think we were at Seminole. I think we skipped Pathfinder last year completely because we were a little concerned about water levels down there. And then they did a bunch of construction up there on they put the new ramp in up at Pathfinder. So it worked out really good. But we did our third event at Seminole and our championship at Boysen. So
this year looking pretty good, and applications are available, and you've already got quite a few boats in for the May.
Yeah, there's 60 boats already turned in for the first two events, and we are capping the second event at Glendo to 140 boats. So, if that's our Gov Cup, kind of rebranding that, some higher payouts, some cool trophies, rings for the winners, jackets for the winners. We're doing a kids event on Friday, so they're going to be able to go fish with a pro or one of the tournament anglers. And we're going to work with Boys and Girls Club and then a group of kids out of the Glendo area. So that's going to be a really neat and rewarding event. We've done that numerous times, and it's always awesome to see those kids, catching fish.
Yeah.
And that usually is a really good event for catching fish. You can catch them just about any way you want. So, if you're going to want to get in on that one, you definitely want to get entries in on that as soon as possible.
So there are four events, the fourth being the championship. Do you have to fish every one, or can you kind of, if you can't make two of them? Or?
No, you can just pick, you can pick one event or two events. If you want to fish the championship, you do have to fish all three events. So it is a qualifier.
Right.
We actually seed that tournament. Skeeter Boats sponsors that, so we have $5,000 from Skeeter that goes into that event, and then usually about another $7,000 just from entries throughout the season that goes towards that. So we have a 60 boat field capped at 60. If we don't have 60 boats to fish all three, it might only be a 40 boat, but they're going to be competing for a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, going to be a good time this year for fishing, whether it's the Stampede or whether it's Jay's weekly event, the
Walleye League at Pathfinder.
Yeah, yeah, and and even opportunities with the Walleye Club to get involved there. So there's just a lot of great things you can start planning to get in on.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've got it pretty good here, and I think a lot of times we complain about certain things about our game and fish, but in terms of walleye populations and our reservoirs and around us, I mean, we've got it pretty dang good pound for pound. Like our fisheries hold up to some of the big bodies of water like Devil's Lake and Lake Oahe and Sakakawea. Yeah, I know, it's that one's a tough one to say, but we've got some great fishing here, and if you haven't been to Pathfinder or Boysen or Keyhole or Seminole, it's definitely worth making the trip and planning a weekend.
All right. Well, if you need to get stuff together for that weekend, come on in and check them out right here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with Drew Kirby. If you have a question, want to make a comment, or have an idea for a show topic, message us on the My Country mobile app. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.